Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find our episodes over on iTunes. Search for Dog Works Radio as well as on dogworksradio.com. Be sure and do us a favor and leave us a review and tell us what you think of the show. It helps out with our rankings and people being able to find us as well. You can also subscribe to our show there on iTunes, and you'll get our show in your inbox or on your iPhone every week. We're going to talk today to a guest we had on right after Iditarod in March. His name is Larry Doherty, and he's calling in today with his son, Calvin. He is 13 years old. They're calling in from the Anchorage, Alaska area, and they did something pretty cool this past month or so, and we look forward to talking to these guys here in just a second. If you guys listened to our episode last time, we talked about what mushers do in the off season. We talked about the Iditarod picnic and what we do to exercise our dogs and, you know, so on and so forth. But we didn't get into what us mushers do in the off season. And not many folks can attest to doing what the Dohertys did this past month when they traveled over to Africa. So we're going to introduce the guys right now, Larry and Calvin. How's it going?
Going great. Thanks for having us on the show, Robert. It's good to be back.
Welcome to the show. All right. So, guys, if we can, Larry, start off. Tell us a little bit about yourself for folks that may not have heard the previous episode. Then we'll jump over to Calvin, okay?
Yeah, sure. You bet. So, name's Larry Doherty. I'm 40 years old, father of five. I'm a radiation oncologist. I treat all different types of cancer in the Anchorage area. And as you said, just finished my rookie Iditarod in March this year.
And Calvin, how about you?
Yeah, my name's Calvin Doherty. I'm 13, and I enjoy like scouting and outdoor kind of things like mountain climbing and camping.
And what grade are you in school?
I just finished 7th grade. I go to Greening Middle School.
Very good. So, Larry, do you guys live in Anchorage, Eagle River, where?
We live right in Eagle River.
Okay. So you get a chance to get out and hike there near the Nature Center and, you know, do some of our, you know, hiking around that part of the country. But you guys did some pretty cool stuff just about a month or so ago. You guys headed over to Africa. So set the tone for us. What did you guys do, and how in the world did you guys plan on doing that expedition?
Sure. So through my profession, a few years ago, a friend and I started a nonprofit. It's called Radiating Hope. For those who watched the Iditarod or saw any coverage of me either at the ceremonial start or coming under the arch, you may have noticed I had some Tibetan prayer flags on my sled, and those I typically carry up mountaintops through my nonprofit in honor of individual cancer patients, and had the privilege to take them across Alaska on the Iditarod. But this climb is an annual event that I organize in Tanzania, and it's really our main fundraiser for Radiating Hope. The purpose of the climb really is to raise money to improve cancer care, access to cancer care in Tanzania. So we've been trying to build a cancer center there for the last 4 or 5 years and also build up and improve the existing scant cancer care that there is there. So we had 24 climbers from around the globe join us on this year's climb. And, yeah, as you said, we just finished a few weeks ago.
So, Calvin, I know you went with your dad when you guys headed over to Africa to climb Kilimanjaro. Had you ever done anything like that in your life? Did you train for it? You know, tell us your take on this pretty cool feat that you did.
So my whole life I've kind of been involved with the outdoors. I've done things similar, but nothing that big. We definitely trained. Like before, we'd go around and do hikes around our area, and so we could prepare ourselves for the climb. We'd wake up in the morning and hike Mount Baldy, wake up at like around 4:30, and then afterward we got smoothies at McDonald's.
So, Larry, tell us about Kilimanjaro. You know, when folks think about mountain climbing, you know, you hear a lot about, Denali and Everest, you know, the two of the, you know, the most aware mountains that people have climbed. What is Kilimanjaro like in relation to those? Is it anything at all the same, or is it entirely different?
Yeah, so I was privileged to climb Denali last year, so I can give a bit of a comparison. Kilimanjaro, it stands at an elevation of 19,341 feet, so a little less elevation than Denali. It's the largest freestanding peak in the world, and it's the tallest mountain on the African continent. In comparison to what we have here in Alaska, it's not nearly the technical challenge of any of our peaks here. I think anyone who's in good shape and trains can do it. It's a strenuous hike, but there's nothing technical about climbing Kilimanjaro. It is a challenge from the serious altitude gain, as well as you can get some inclement weather that can come in. Unique in the scenery and in the location, certainly just going to Africa, but you go through four different ecosystems. Yeah, you start in a rainforest. We're fortunate to see some monkeys swinging in the trees, and then kind of as you go up, you go through, you know, an alpine desert type region, and eventually get up. You aren't actually on a glacier, but you have glaciers kind of on either side of you as you crest the crater rim up near the summit. So you're kind of walking in between a couple glaciers. You walk through a little bit of snow, but certainly nothing compared to the technical challenge of Denali. You don't rope up. It doesn't require, you know, harnesses or anything technical. But is a, I think for most people that were on the climb, even those who have done, you know, very physical things in the past, they would probably tell you that even though it's not a technical challenge, it was the hardest physical thing that they've done. And, you know, most of these folks were adults. So it was pretty cool to be able to do it with my 13-year-old son.
That is very cool for sure. Calvin, tell us about the trip over. You know, that's literally on the other side of the world from Alaska. How long did it take you guys to get there? What was it like traveling through all those different countries, you know, the different customs? Tell us a little bit about your trip over.
So the flight to Tanzania was, I think it was 30 hours, and there's an 11-hour
wow.
time difference, so yeah, definitely far away. We passed through Amsterdam on our way, and the airport there was really unique. It was really big and huge, pretty much. And then from there we flew to we flew across the Arctic, basically to Amsterdam, so we flew across the top of the Earth. And then
right.
from there, we flew down to Tanzania. And when we got there, and the airports were so different between the Tanzania one and the Amsterdam one, because the Tanzania one was obviously much smaller. But it was really cool when we got there to, like, see the people and, like, the customs and their houses and driving.
When you're in Tanzania there, describe that for us, Calvin. What's it like? You know, is it, kind of bush type living? Is it a big city where you guys went? What was the food like? That sort of thing.
So it was kind of a mix between like a city and suburbs. Like it was, the houses were all, they were like pretty much made of things you'd find on the side of the road. And they were just built
okay.
next to the road. And the food there was really good. We had some pretty good food on the mountain. So, yeah, very different from America, though. We also had the opportunity to
Go ahead.
Oh, we also had the opportunity to visit one of the local tribes called the Maasai, and they had these villages made of, like, mud huts, and they had, like, a wall made of brambles, and it was really cool.
So did you get to try anything to eat that you had never tried before? Maybe tell us about that, something that, you know, just something you're always going to remember.
The pineapple, they had a new soda there. It's called Pineapple Santa. And I really like that beverage when we were over there. But the food was mostly the same. Like, it was like rice and chicken and things like that.
Right, right. So, Larry, at the top of the show, you were telling, and I know you had mentioned this quite a bit on your previous interview, but you were telling us about the foundation and why you guys do this. Lay that out for us a little bit. Maybe tell us about, you know, some of the struggles that they're dealing with over there in that part of the world. You know, a lot of people watch, you know, Frontline and documentaries and things and see how other folks live, but very rarely do they get to hear, you know, boots on the ground type stuff on what folks are really like. What do you got? What is your mission when you're over there, and has it been successful?
Sure. So, Tanzania, you know, it's a country of over 45 million people with essentially no access to cancer care. There's one cancer center in the nation's capital, the city called Dar es Salaam, over near Zanzibar. My specialty of medicine, radiation oncology, is a very technologically dependent field. Probably the most, if not at least one of the most rapidly developing areas of medicine, just kind of tip of the sword of oncology. Very expensive machines, you know, on the order of a couple of $1 million for these radiation machines that are used to treat cancer. For many different types of cancer, you know, the kind of the three pillars of oncology are surgery, chemotherapy, radiation therapy. There are certain types of cancer that are incurable without access to radiation services. And in Tanzania, there's one very primitive machine that sometimes is working, sometimes is not working, and certainly, you know, not enough to service 45 million people. A country of that size, you know, in the United States, we have about one radiation machine for every 30 to 40,000 people. And over there to have one for 45 million, it's just not nearly enough. So, our organization, Radiating Hope, is very specific to try to improve access to radiation therapy services. Enormous hurdles to do that, both from a staffing standpoint, from a logistical standpoint, from an electricity standpoint. They have these rolling blackouts 30 and 40 times a day because the electrical grid system is just not up to par. So some portions of the day, you know, certain parts of the city will have electricity, and then it's, you know, to other parts, and that creates a challenge. There's also a lot of challenge just with education. Cancer is very taboo among many of the tribes. If a woman has breast cancer, for instance, if they even know and can recognize that that's cancer, it's almost seen as a curse. You know, some of these people are exiled or, you know, put in isolation and just, you know, really have no treatment whatsoever. And very curable diseases here in the United States, people die of every single day in Tanzania. So have we been successful? We've made some strides. We were fortunate to get we've had donations of well over $1 million in cash and also equipment through our climbing efforts. We had an equipment donation from the Mayo Clinic of a linear accelerator, which is a radiation machine, as well as another private donation of another type of radiation machine. We are installing those this year at a cancer center in Mwanza, which is a city not far from Kilimanjaro. So we're making some strides. We've got a long, long way to go, though, but we plan to have a presence in Tanzania for a long, long time. So this climb will be an annual event, So we're already in the next phase of planning next year's climb.
Excellent. Alex, you're joining us from Southern California, just a little bit late to the program. Welcome, Alex. We're just talking to Larry and his son Calvin about their recent trip over to Africa and climbing Kilimanjaro, and we've talked a little bit about the trip over, what the climb is like, and talked about some pretty interesting soda that that Calvin found over there that I think he wants to grab a case or two of over here in the U.S. Alex, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Sorry for the mix-up with the time. But always enjoy hearing about your adventures, Larry.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having us, Alex. Good to talk to you again.
So, Alex, jump on in there. Do you have a question for either Calvin or Larry as we're about halfway through the show here?
And forgive me if you covered this already, but was there a particular reason why you wanted to go to Kilimanjaro as opposed to, anywhere else that you guys could have gone?
Yeah, sure. So through Radiating Hope, we actually organize climbs all over the world. We've done climbs on six of the seven highest peaks of the seven summits anyway. And very frequently we'll have folks approach us and want to organize a climb, say on Mount Rainier, or last year I took a group up Denali. Africa, we just felt like Kilimanjaro really is a great symbol for that continent being the high point of Africa, that's kind of why we've chosen it as our central focus for fundraising in Africa.
So this question is for both Larry and Calvin. First off, Larry, you said that you are one of the folks that plans this expedition. Do you get into all the logistics of the climb itself, or are you more of an advisor and allow maybe an expedition company to do this? And then to Calvin, you had mentioned that you're involved with scouts. Is that right?
Yeah.
And your question is any of this helpful in your studies as a scout, maybe in the future as an Eagle Scout project or something like that?
So, yeah, when we were in Africa, I actually found out what I wanted to do for my Eagle project. On the mountain, the porters were there, and they helped us, carrying, our tents and our stuff for the climb. And so for my Eagle project, I'm going to try and, send a bunch of gear over there to help them, because they climbed the mountain, three times a month, and they didn't really have the proper gear to do it. But, yeah, their shoes were, they were wearing, cleats, and it was kind of sad, but I just felt like I really wanted to help them.
Right. And how about you, Larry? What
yeah.
is your involvement in planning the trip?
Yeah, sure. So for Kilimanjaro specifically, you have to use a guided company. So we partner with a local climbing company called Klein Kili every year. And we've got a lot of buy-in from them in that they essentially give us the climb for cost. We still charge what the company would normally charge for the climb. And essentially they end up donating pretty close to $1,000 per climber that comes with us back to Radiating Hope. So, they handle all the logistics, the travel agent type stuff of picking people up from the airport and even, meals on the mountain. Every guided group comes with a large group of porters. We had over 100 porters for 24 climbers doing things like, carrying tents up, cooking, anything to support all of us. It's a pretty impressive operation.
Alex, next question?
Larry, I'm wondering, and this may be an impossible question, so if it is, I apologize in advance, but how would you compare the challenges of running Iditarod to the challenges of climbing a mountain like Kilimanjaro?
Yeah, I think the challenges are just different. it's really interesting to climb with other oncologists. I almost always climb with other doctors or those who are somewhat involved with cancer. And as you climb up to elevation and you feel, you know, fatigue, but also things like nausea, vomiting, headache, diarrhea, it's really kind of an interesting journey and one that parallels nicely what many of our patients go through on their cancer journey. So for the first time, you know, many oncologists are taking medications like Zofran or Imodium, things that they prescribe and give out almost like candy to their patients every single day. So I would say from an ailment standpoint, it's the altitude, you know, physically is a challenge, but you don't have the sleep deprivation, nearly the cold I must say that there's really nothing that compares to the Iditarod, but it is a different set of circumstances.
To either Calvin or Larry here, when you guys started, what is the elevation like? I used to climb, you know, 14ers when we lived in California or Colorado, and you start out at least 5,000 feet in Denver, then work your way up to the 14ers, and typically you're starting much higher than that, depending on where the mountain is located. What is the elevation for, you know, at the base of the mountain, because you had mentioned that it was 19,000 feet as you work your way up, and did you have to do anything to acclimate yourself on the way up, you know, going from that level to the highest level?
So we started the climb at about 6,000 feet, and as we were starting the climb, they would say poli poli, which means in local language, slow, slow. So basically they were telling us to not go too fast because we would, the altitude would get to us faster. And they had a saying where it was climb high, sleep low. So you would get used to the altitude when you climbed up like higher than you slept the previous night. And then you would camp just a little bit higher, or camp a little higher over how high you camped the last night. So each day you're pretty much like going over a kind of a hill kind of thing. But once you really get up there on probably like the third or fourth day is when you really start to feel the altitude, and you just feel really sick, and you feel like you have a fever and a headache, and you just feel like throwing up. So.
Okay.
And you know, Calvin.
Alex, question? Oh, go ahead, Larry.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, Calvin really was afflicted by the altitude, just very, very challenging from about the third day on. I've climbed with a lot of different folks, and I mean, watching my poor kid just really retching and puking his guts out and just really, really, really struggling from the altitude. A lot of adults would have turned around. He really powered through. I just couldn't have been more proud. It's cool to watch your kid do something just enormously difficult and not give up. And that, I think that was definitely the hardest part, wouldn't you say, Cal, for you?
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome.
You know, I'm wondering from both of you, what was the one thing in climbing this? I imagine that you both had done, you know, a lot of preparation and a lot of mental preparation. But what was the thing that was the most surprising to you that you hadn't really expected that you encountered when you were climbing the mountain?
You want to take that, Cal?
I didn't really expect the altitude to be as bad as it was. I thought it would be lighter because I'd never really been that high, so I couldn't know. But it hit me, and it was just like a whole new thing that I had never really felt.
I guess for me, this was actually my second time going up Kilimanjaro. I got to go with my wife and my daughter 2 years ago when I organized the trip. And I think for me, it was seeing the success of our group. 23 out of the 24 folks that were with us made it to the top. So that was a surprise to me.
Very cool. Are you still there?
Yep, sorry about that.
Oops. Oh, that's okay. Either Calvin or Larry, for this one, did you guys You know, in diving, there's kind of an underwritten rule that you're not allowed to dive. I believe the day that you get there and your last day before you leave when you're coming or going to a dive destination. Is there anything like that with climbing expeditions that you're aware of?
In terms of not diving before you climb, is that what you're asking?
No.
You know, in diving, there's sort of a rule that you can't do it the day you get there or the day before you leave. Is there something like that with climbing where you have to kind of acclimate?
Yeah, you know, adjusting to altitude really is all about just, like Calvin said, pole, taking it slow and taking time to acclimate. Early in my mountaineering career, I was trying to summit the tallest mountain in Argentina or in South America, to Aconcagua. And I had kind of a dangerous altitude event where I got fluid in my lungs and had to, descend very quickly. And really it was because my team was just being very aggressive with our speed going up faster than my physiology was really capable of. So it's just about going up slowly with your altitude gain every day. Like Calvin said, you know, climb high, sleep low. You expose your body to a higher altitude than you sleep generally, but just giving it time. So a mountain like Kilimanjaro, it took our team 7 days, and that's just about the right amount of time to do it safely.
Right. Alex?
So I'm wondering, I guess, specifically from Calvin, now that you've done this, which is certainly an accomplishment that most people haven't done, let alone most people your age, do you have in mind any next really big challenge that you're looking at or that you're setting for yourself?
So this August, we're actually going to climb Mount Rainier in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have a few other mountains planned that we might be doing in the next couple of years. So, yeah, I definitely want to do more big things like that.
Excellent.
Larry, in a mushing parallel, you're only as fast as your slowest dog, you know, on your mushing team. Is that similar in mountaineering or climbing, where the group sort of holds back for the slowest member, or are you sort of trudging along at your own pace and allowing the, you call them porters or Sherpas like they use in Everest, or do they sort of take care of that, or do you guys all kind of travel together?
I would say for most serious mountaineering, you know, take a peak like Denali where you're roped up. It's certainly the case. You know, you're only going to go as fast as your slowest team member. But Kilimanjaro is a little bit unique that way. There's, like I said, a huge support staff of porters. On summit day, our team kind of got spread out by speed and skill level, and so we kind of split up into groups of similar speed. And some situations where folks were really struggling, it became a one-on-one situation with a porter or a guide. And so no, not necessarily dependent on the slowest member.
Okay. Alex?
You know, I'm wondering for both of you, how did you feel when you were up at the top, when you'd summited and you were looking around? Was it, what was going through your minds when that happened for each of you?
So when I reached the top, I was really relieved because I thought like I wasn't going to be able to make it that day because I was like so sick and affected by the altitude. But then I saw the top and it just kind of reinvigorated me and I got excited. And yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. You know, for me, summit night was just really, really challenging for Calvin, and you know, being totally honest, there were several moments where I thought, oh man, it was almost like I was secretly hoping that he would turn around because he was just suffering so much going up, and there were several moments where I thought he was going to turn around, and you know, the night was super cold, and you know, you get a little bit of a morale booster finally when the sun comes up. But to get up there on that crater rim and once we kind of crested that, it's about another hour to get to the top, but a much gentler hour than the rest of the night was. Once we got to that crater rim, I knew he was going to make it, and he kind of got a second wind and had a little pep in his step, and it was just a mixture of enormous pride in my son and also a little bit of shock that he had done it. So it was just really incredible to be up there and experience it with him. And you know, top of Kilimanjaro, you can start to appreciate the curvature of the earth. We had a nice, clear day, really beautiful weather. So just stunning views all around. Just amazing. Kind of like the Iditarod. It's one of those things that's just hard to put into words unless you experience it.
Awesome stuff. So, Calvin, my last question is to you. Then I'll have Alex finish us up here since he came a little late on the show. You had mentioned, Calvin, that you guys are going to do Mount Rainier in just a couple of months. And that's an entirely different animal than Kilimanjaro, from my understanding, at least from the technical portion. It's more of a technical-type mountain, if I'm correct. What are you doing to work up to that, since you sort of struggled with the altitude at 19,000 feet? What are you doing for this climb that you didn't do, or you're learning how to do for the next one?
So actually, a few nights ago, we got the team for Rainier together, and my dad showed us like how to properly if you fall into a crevasse, how to properly handle that, and the right knots you're going to need and how you use them. And then also pretty soon we're going to go to the Mount Nisga Glacier and train in there for like ice climbing and crevasse rescue. We're also going to start training with heavier packs because we won't have porters. And it's a 3-day climb, so we're going to be carrying all our stuff. So yeah, heavier packs and ice work, ropes.
So how are you going to deal with the altitude problems that you had there on Kilimanjaro? Is there a way to sort of defeat that some way? You know, I know that in mountaineering, that's sort of the thing that gets most people is that altitude.
So there's a couple things you can do. You can tell yourself before the climb that you're just going to make it because, I mean, the altitude isn't going to kill you. You can also do things like you can do a bunch of sprints, and that'll kind of prepare your mind, I guess. So we'll definitely be doing more of those than we did for Kilimanjaro. But I think I won't have as much of a problem because I've already exposed myself to a higher elevation. I mean, Rainier's not as tall as Kilimanjaro.
Alex, if you don't mind, I got to follow this up with Larry.
Sure.
As a physician, what can the youngster do to prepare himself? I heard you kind of giggle when you said that the altitude can't kill you. I know on Everest they have that death zone or that death area there.
Oh yeah.
What can somebody do
no.
to prepare themselves?
Yeah, the altitude definitely can kill you, Cal. You know, it's really interesting and with the physiology of it. Altitude illness has very little to do with fitness. In fact, there's almost an inverse relationship with altitude illness and fitness. Young, healthy males who are very fit are the most prone to get altitude illness. So you can train. You definitely want to take out of the equation fitness because that can make you more prone to altitude issues. You know, one thing you can do to try to just simulate altitude that Cal and I have done together is interval training, where, you know, you do sprints on a treadmill, sprints on a Stairmaster, and just get your body to that point of breathlessness and get your heart rate up. And I think if anything, that just kind of helps mentally prepare you for what it's going to feel like to be at elevation, where you're just moving so slow and every step is just, you know, agony at some level. Your heart's racing. You just feel like you're not getting enough air. So getting to those sprints where it's like, oh man, I don't feel like I can do one more. And you do, you know, one more sprint for a solid minute. I think it helps mentally prepare you. But physically, I think the real answer is you have to listen to your body and just take the right pace. And if you're having certain symptoms and your body's telling you to not go any higher, you do that. I learned that lesson the hard way, as I mentioned before. So just have to be safe is number one priority.
Is there some type of like red blood cell replacement or something like that, either before or after, that may help?
You know, there's a medicine called Diamox that some folks use. It's a diuretic. I'm not a fan of really any medication that can enhance your performance in mountaineering, primarily because I was actually using that medicine when I tried to climb Aconcagua, and ended up feeling like in the end that medicine was masking some of the symptoms that I would have otherwise been feeling, and probably would have had me, you know, turn around sooner or go slower, take additional time. So I'm a fan of not using any medication other than, you know, things like ibuprofen to deal with a headache or maybe Zofran or some sort of medicine to deal with nausea. But there are some people who use hypobaric chambers to prepare mm-hmm. for really serious altitude. There was actually a couple climbers on our trip that did that. There's mixed science as to whether or not those are effective. But really the key answer is time. You know, the reason why Sherpas are used on Mount Everest is because they live at really high altitudes and they do have a higher hemoglobin count than folks that live at lower elevations. So they're able to perform better at altitude. So giving yourself an edge by preparing, climbing, say, a 10,000 or a 14,000 foot peak, you know, that certainly can enhance your performance.
Excellent. Alex, last question before we wrap up with the guys.
Sure. And just before I ask the last question, I just wanted to say again that it's always amazing to talk to people who really just take life by the horns and live to the fullest. And I think that your adventures, Larry, and with this climb, Calvin, you as well, are just really wonderful examples of that. And I apologize if this question is a little bit silly, but I wanted to know if either of you had seen the movie Everest that came out, I think, last year or the year before. And if you had, what you thought of it, either, you know, just what you thought of it or what you thought of it in light of having just climbed this mountain.
Sure. Have you seen it, Cal? That
no.
Movie? Okay. Yeah, I'll give you my thoughts on it. So I read the book, real familiar with the 1996 tragedy. I read John Krakauer's account, Into Thin Air, which never really liked that much, to be honest with you. I felt like he kind of painted himself as the hero and villainized Anatoly Boukreev, who was the one climber who rescued anyone. There was controversy because he was a guide and he insisted on climbing without oxygen, and that was kind of Krakauer's grind against him. But I actually really liked the movie much more than the book. I thought it was a much more fair portrayal of probably what really happened between Krakauer and Boukreev. And I thought the movie was pretty well done. I wish I hadn't taken my wife to see it. It was
directed by this guy named Balthasar Karnekar, who is my favorite Icelandic director. And he's done a number of films in English and a number of films in Icelandic, and they're all pretty impressive, but this is the first one I've seen of his that is, you know, really just a big budget, really big movie, and it was very exciting to me, and I've read the Krakauer book too, and I thought this was just a very, very good depiction of those events. And also, for me, as someone who hasn't climbed anything anywhere near that big, it gave me a much clearer sense of what it was like to be up on the mountain.
Yeah, it was very well done. It was a good movie.
So, Larry, if I can follow up with that, I know we ran over. I hope I'm not jumping into too much of your guys' time. But you had mentioned that you climbed most of the highest peaks that you can, and I'm sure that Everest is somewhere in the back of your mind somewhere. What are your thoughts about all of that, you know, all the talk that's going on about, you know, sort of the Everest, you know, the chance at Everest is kind of eluding now. You know, many people are doing it less than they've done in the past, you know, with the earthquakes and, you know, all of that that goes on. What are your thoughts on that? I'm sure you've thought about it at least on some level. As you're going around the world climbing all these peaks?
Yeah, sure. So it's definitely been something that's always been a goal of mine. I hope to someday be able to do it. Our Radiating Hope is actually sending a team next year up Mount Everest, and we're also doing a large fundraiser surrounding a trek to Everest Base Camp. That really anybody could do. So if there's anybody listening that might want to join on that, they're more than welcome to visit our website and look into that. But Everest, you know, because it's the tallest mountain in the world, I think we just hear more about the dangers of Everest. I haven't climbed Everest, but my sense, you know, after having climbed Denali and talked to folks who've done both Denali independent, you know, not through a guided service, and Everest. I think many folks would tell you that doing Denali on your own is probably harder than doing Everest. On Everest, you have a one-to-one Sherpa. You know, Sherpas are carrying your stuff. They're, you know, cooking for you, setting up your tent. And on Denali, you're on your own, you know, carrying 100 or 120 pounds of gear and doing all those things on your own, melting snow for your water, cooking for yourself, you know, building snow walls. So in some ways, I think that, you know, Everest would you know, I dare say be easier than Denali. But we do hear about the tragedies on Everest, you know, year after year. And certainly I'm not minimizing the risk that's associated with it. The thing I think that would scare me the most about Everest isn't necessarily the climb itself. It is the crowds and the legion of folks who really shouldn't be there, don't have the experience to be on Everest. There's still people that climb year after year Everest as their first serious mountain. They're guiding outfits that allow them to do that. It's not regulated like it should be. Through the government or through the Park Service over there, so that really results in the crowds on the Hillary Step or, you know, elsewhere through the ice fall, where you have folks who just aren't technically prepared to do it, and when there's long lines and then weather moves in, that's really where these tragedies oftentimes unfortunately end up happening. There have been these real unlucky events with the avalanche a couple years ago and then the earthquake last year. But you look at most of the tragedies on Everest, a lot of them, unfortunately, are preventable.
Right. And, you know, we could have an entire other show about the parallels between what you had just mentioned about being prepared and not for the Iditarod as well. I think we talked about that on your previous show where we mentioned if you were – thought you were ready to go when you left the starting line in Willow and when you finished there in Nome. So I know we heard from Calvin. He mentioned what's next. He talked about his Eagle project as well as climbing Mount Rainier with you, Larry. What is next for you? Maybe with the foundation, what's happening with, is there any other mushing in your life coming up? What's next for the Doherty family there?
Yeah, well, I think that is what's next is, you know, Dad's been absent really the last couple of years training for the Iditarod. How I wouldn't love to do the Iditarod again. You know, someday I plan to, not planning on doing it next year, or probably not in the next couple of years. Just finished a great scout camp with Calvin, got to be there for that last week, and he and I are going to climb Rainier together, and And so I'm focusing on doing things that I can do with my kids, you know, still having adventures, but having them with my family. That was harder to do with mushing without having my own kennel. Hard to have a kennel when you're working full time as a doc. Who knows? Maybe someday I'll be able to do that as well. But for now, plenty of adventures that I'd love to do, but focusing on ones I can do with my kids.
And you guys just are recently moved to Alaska, so there's a heck of a lot of stuff to do up here as well. So get out there and enjoy that Alaskan summer. We've had great weather here the last couple of months. I know we talked in depth about it, Alex and I, about all the things to do up here when it's not snowing up here in Alaska. So get out there and enjoy the time with the family, to the Dohertys. And we'll keep in touch for sure. I'm interested in that Eagle project that Calvin's doing. Maybe we'll have him back on when he gets that finished. We're not only a mushing show, but we definitely share those adventures, as Alex mentioned, just taking life by the horns and running with it. Larry and Calvin, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Larry, do you have a website that you would like to mention for the Radiating Hope Foundation?
I appreciate that. The website is www.radiatinghope.org, and we also have a Facebook page, just Radiating Hope. So check us out on either one of those. And like I said, we invite anybody and everybody to join us on the annual Kilimanjaro climb or the Everspace Camp Trek next year. It would be another awesome opportunity.
Excellent. Thank you very much for joining us, guys. Calvin, heck of a journey there. Good luck to you on Rainier. I'm sure you guys will do well. And Alex, speaking of Iditarod and Everest, just next week we're going to have on Cindy Abbott. She's going to talk about her brand new movie, Banner on the Moon. I'm looking forward to that. If you haven't checked that out, you can find it on iTunes. I believe it's also on Amazon Prime. I know that you have a little bit of a part in the movie as well as Mushing Radio. You want to bring up or sort of showcase what we're going to talk about with Cindy coming up on our next episode?
Yeah, well, we've spoken to Cindy before, and Cindy is someone who has a degenerative eye disease, but did not let that stop her from summiting Mount Everest. And then after having summited Mount Everest, she called Lance Mackey and said, "I just climbed Mount Everest and I want to run the Iditarod. Can you teach me how to run dogs?" So she had a lot of adventures with him, and then did not finish her first year, and I believe did not finish her second year either. Started working with Vern Halter, your neighbor. And then finished Iditarod, and I believe she has just retired from her teaching position down here in Southern California, moved up to Alaska, and is she entered the Iditarod on the picnic, and was one of two people who got her name chosen, so she gets her entry fee back. So all sorts of great stuff to talk to her about, and you know, we talk a lot about people who get the bug and who just are exposed to mushing and then they can't step away from it. And it seems that she's someone who probably fits into that category.
Excellent. We'll definitely be talking to Cindy next Wednesday at our regular time, 5 p.m. here in the Matsu Valley on KVRF. That's radiofreepalmer.org. And again, you can find us over on iTunes as well to search for Dog Works Radio. Again, thanks to the Dohertys, Calvin, and Larry for joining us this evening. We look forward to hearing about your guys' adventures. You can follow those guys on Facebook. I'm sure that they're pretty accessible there, and they'll accept that friend request, and you can see all their cool pictures there on Kilimanjaro. That's definitely cool stuff. So again, thank you to our guest tonight, and on behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, we will see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.